You've tuned in to the Roundtable Podcast, episode 26.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
On the Roundtable Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and pitch a story idea to Brian and I and our esteemed guest host.
Absolutely. And then we dig into it, root around a little bit, see what works, what doesn't, and come up with some really interesting things to throw at the writer and have the writer throw at us and try to fine-tune it into a solid and writable story and what Dave loves to call
literary gold.
That's right, literary gold.
Oh my goodness, Brian, we got rain.
You got rain?
We got rain in Tennessee. Oh my god,
I hate you.
Well, I know, and
it's 100 degrees here right now.
I'm so sorry to hear that, but for a month there I wasn't mowing the lawn because it would be like, you know, throwing thatch up into the air. And I know we swore we would never talk about freaking weather.
I was just
again.
I thought you put a moratorium on
I did that, I did but You know
Dave doesn't follow his own rules.
What a shot. I'm just so excited. Well, partially because there's a lot of guy points that you acquire by riding around on a riding mower.
Well, of course.
And
yeah,
I haven't been racking up those guy points for weeks now because it would be like throwing dirt in the air.
Right.
So I'm glad to be getting my guy points back.
That's good. That's excellent. I actually mowed my lawn today and almost had heat stroke.
Wow.
Are you
okay?
I'm good. I lost a few brain cells, so I'm a little slow today, but it's okay.
Actually, this delirium will actually serve us well in the coming episode, I'm sure. So go ahead and nurture that. And, you know, in talking about you and me mowing our lawns, I realized why I put a moratorium on weather conversation. Let's never do that again. Ever. Instead,
Hey, you're the one that broke the rules.
I know.
I'm following your lead, dude.
Feel free to smack me down. And let's just... Let's put that aside and find something really interesting to talk about, like perhaps our guest host. Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome her back after her 20 minutes with segment. This person has created wonders of many flavors and shades and nuances from all manner of steampunk, horror, alternate history, gothic, urban fantasy. Her book, Bone Shaker, has won Locus Awards, been nominated for Hugo's and Nebula's, and is optioned to be a motion picture squee, and is generally coming at the world sideways, which is always an intriguing perspective. Please welcome back to the big chair at the round table, Sherry Priest. Sherry, thanks for rejoining us on the Roundtable Podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. Now, you have so much stuff going on. I can't help but ask and wonder what's coming up next. What do the fans of Sherry Priest need to know in terms of what's coming up in the coming months and years?
Oh, gosh. Well, this fall, we have the next steampunk book. I think it's, depending on your count, I think it's either four or five. It's called The Inexplicable, in which I guarantee you at least one zombie Sasquatch.
A zombie Sasquatch?
Get people what awesome. They want. A zombie Sasquatch in the city of Seattle in 1880.
I love it.
Sure, why not? Yeah, I thought it would be fun, and that's usually my entire motivation. Well, I thought it would be fun, and it is. It's great. It's about a teenage juvenile delinquent who goes into the city because he thinks he's being haunted by the ghost of a kid he believes he might have accidentally killed. But there's a zombie Sasquatch in the mix, so, you know.
Tune in, absolutely.
Yeah, it's in the same universe as Bone Shaker, the Clockwork Century. And then next year we have Fiddlehead, which will happen in D.C. and will end the war, which... Partly, I mean, I'm from the Southeast, where, I mean, let's be honest, alternate theories of the Civil War are kind of a regional pastime. And, sure. Yeah, and so, you know, it's fine and it's been fun, but I think it's time to wrap this up by 1880. But let's see, yeah, if there's a Bone Shaker movie, I would be happy to give you more information on that. But it was picked up by Hammer Films, the old UK studio, and
Cross Creek, awesome.
The people who did Black Swan. And we have a script that's been greenlit, I believe. It's written by John Shepard, the guy who does Nurse Jackie for HBO.
Oh, wow. How much input did you...
That's kind of all I know right now.
How much input did you have on the script? Anything?
None, not a bit, and that's fine.
That's very Hollywood.
I trust John. He's fantastic, and no, I mean you know when you sign over the option that they're going to do what they're going to do, and that's not really up to you.
Right.
And sure. I'm at peace with that. So, if this movie gets made, that's a very big fat check, and they can do whatever they want with it, frankly.
Well, and Hammer Films, I mean, Black Swan was gorgeous. I can only imagine what they're going to do with Bone Shaker.
Hammer, that was Cross Creek.
Hammer
just did The Woman in Black.
Oh, yes.
The Daniel Radcliffe vehicle right after Harry Potter, and it was gorgeous.
That was awesome. People can set the scene.
Yeah, so I'm really excited. I can't wait to see what happens, and I hope this goes through. But right now I just have those two in the queue, and then I think I might shift gears for a little while. But I don't know, maybe not. Steampunk has been very good to me, so we'll see.
Outstanding. That's very cool. And it's interesting with your Clockwork Century series that it's not necessarily you can call it a series, but it's not like you're actually following the same characters. It's as you were saying, the setting is the only really consistent character from one book to another.
Mm-hmm. I like to overlap people here and there, though. You know,
sure.
I like to kind of bring them in and bring them out. And my steampunk Texas Ranger from Dreadnought shows up in Ganymede, for example, and Maria Boyd from Clementine, the shorter one I did with Subterranean, will be back for Fiddlehead. And so, you know, if they're interesting characters and I can think of something fun to do with them, I'm happy to play around.
Absolutely. What about your con schedule? What conventions are you planning on attending this year?
This year, actually, I'd mostly tapped out. I'm doing Mile High Con in Denver. But this year, I cut my travel schedule drastically because I bought a house in Tennessee and moved here from Seattle. I'd lived in Tennessee for years and years. My husband's from here in Chattanooga. And so we knew that come, you know, beginning of May, our lives were kind of going to go upside down for a while.
Right.
And so we're here. We've been here for about 2 months. And in those 2 months, I've already done, I think, 3 out-of-state flights for the set and the other. But I made a concerted effort. And I still have a book I need to hand in by the end of September that I have barely started. But I knew it was going to come to this, and so I very pointedly cleared out most of my schedule. So I'm doing Mile High Con in Denver, and I'm doing a regional literary festival in Georgia, and I think that's pretty much it for this year.
Well, if we have any listeners out there in Colorado land, Brian, there is apparently a con in Denver, Mile High Con, Brian.
I already wrote it down and looked it up.
Where you can visit Sherry Priest and, of course, dip into all of the wonders and delights that are available in ebook, Dead Tree Variety, and several in audio form as well.
Yeah, new and exciting for me. So.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, look, why don't we pause here? We'll give some precious air times to another awesome podcast or ebook or literary endeavor of one of our many podcasting peers. And when we get back, we can workshop a story. How's it sound?
Fabulous.
Alrighty.
Awesome. I like the idea too. So friends, stay tuned. We will be right back. It was raining in Tinseltown. A hard rain that washed the trash into the gutters. And some of that trash talks. Sings like a canary if you lay down enough cabbage. Or shove a Roscoe in his gob. Benny the Goose was a small-time grifter fresh out of the caboose after doing a 3-spot for bracing the wrong mark. I slapped a sawbuck in his mitts and made sure he saw I was healed before I asked him, "Where is it?" Benny wasn't a sap, and my reputation as Big Charlie's button man gave me a whole lot of pull on this side of town. He spilled like a round-bottomed jug. It took some legwork and a few rounds of hot lead, but eventually I glommed what I was looking for. A letter that every high pillow in L.A. had his torpedoes out looking for. I could foist it for some serious berries. But before I did, I figured I should read it. For adventure from a bygone era, the letter read, tune in to Protecting Project Pulp, a weekly podcast of classic pulp tales guaranteed to get your pulse pounding. You can tune into the thrills of Protecting Project Pulp starting Tuesday, July 17th. Visit their website at www.protectingprojectpulp.com for more information. Protecting Project Pulp, where adventure truly begins.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, and I think it's that fun time to roll into the roundtable workshop proper. We have still with us Sherry Priest, and I think we're going to get into a tale of murder and political intrigue, which is pretty sweet for me. So, Dave, tell us about our writer.
Absolutely. Our guest writer for this episode, without whom the episode does not occur, is actually an American living in the UK. And her work was recently featured on New Fiction Writers Podcast. We recently had Tony Whitford on and Jay Langjans of the New Fiction Writers Podcast fame. Her piece, The Islander, was showcased on that awesome podcast, which is based, the story was based on a song by Nightwish of the same name about a guy who finds himself, who meets himself when he dies, which just sounds all kinds of bizarrely delicious. prior to that, her literary accolades were fairly limited to, in 2005, the Freedom Foundation at Valley Forge Award for her essay, Keeping America Strong. She is a writer, a woman of many gifts and talents, and we are so grateful to have her on the Skype line. Friends, please welcome Miss Riley James Keith. Riley, thank you, thank you, thank you for stepping up and offering a story for the roundtable. We really appreciate it.
Definitely.
Oh, I appreciate you guys having me on. Good Lord, you're making me blush all the way over here in the UK.
My work is done here. Awesome.
That's right. So, your reach went across the pond there, Dave.
Yes.
That's excellent.
Yes,
my power continues to grow. Yes. The power of the intro. Riley, tell us, how did you get afflicted with this writing virus that seems to be sweeping the nation and the world?
So I lived in Utah. God help me. I lived in Utah for 7 years.
Wow.
My dad was stationed on Hill Air Force Base when he was still in the service. And I had these friends. We all called ourselves the corner crowd because of where we were in this old high school that had been standing since the 50s. Had a bomb shelter and everything. It was awesome. And we would actually sit there and we would pitch stories to each other. And later on, as the years went down, I would learn that they were called fan fictions because they starred me and my friends. But out of all of us, I actually kept writing. I've been writing since I was 13, and I wrote while I was in the Navy. I actually killed everybody in a story because I was angry at my boss in the Navy on the USNS Saturn. Yeah, that was fun. I was actually after a 12-hour-long watch through the Suez Canal. I'll never forget that.
Wow.
So mad at him. And then
so spec fic really is an emotional release for culture
is,
and society.
And when everybody dies at the end, it's brilliant. Yeah, a lot of anger gets out.
Well, you brought a story to the table that continues that vein of mayhem and murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems to be a theme with me. I've
learned. Yeah, might want to get that looked at.
Murder. Yay!
Well, let's dive into that then. Let's explore this story. We're going to give you 5 to 8 minutes, Riley.
Okay.
Give us the title, the genre, the format. Is it going to be a short story, novel, whatever? Introduce us to some of the key characters, and then give us a quick overview of the story arc as you see it so far.
Right.
And we'll rock it on from there. So the mic is all yours. Take it away.
Okay. If I talk too fast, let me know, because I have a problem with that. I've been told this my
entire
life.
It didn't stop me.
Right. Okay. So the story is actually a novel. It's a steampunk dieselpunk fusion, just because of the timeline that it's in. It's called Blood in the Quarter, or The Curious Case of the Quarter Killer and What Happened at the Nightly Edition. Now, the hook is a life saved under one condition. A lie is exposed for the truth. One girl's death and a little red book will change one city forever. The story, or the novel, is set in Prohibition-era New Orleans. It's 1925, but not as the history books say. Standard Oil and Company and the Cato Pine Line have not made the trip down the Mississippi, leaving New Orleans stuck in a battle for supremacy between oil, electricity, and steam. Storyville, by miracle of legislation, has not been closed and plays gatekeeper to the heart of the city, a vast network of underground pipelines run on steam. The city is a patchwork of automatons, timepieces, shifters left over from the Great War, and their aquatic counterparts. Racism is not limited to the color of one's skin, but luckily a drink is still 7 minutes away off the Pontchartrain Island Bridge. My characters are as follows. Burlesque dancer, reporter, bartender, and protagonist, Melanie Ann Maureen Moore. She is opposed, thwarted, irritated by, and maybe a little obsessed with Bertrand James Winston Lautrec. And my supporting cast is my reluctant doctor, George Thomas Nathaniel Reddington, Nightly Edition owner, Joseph Rothberger, rich boy, Jacob Winston Lautrec, cowardly Irishman, Mike and Kilpatrick O'Har, and doom timepiece, Elizabeth Lizzie Emmeline Reddington, and detective team, Claire Costedge and Frank Scorzapullo. And finally, two last guys, the man things happen to, Mr. Saturday, and the doom pipe worker, Mr. Dennis Strapping. Both Melanie and Bertrand are motivated by money. Bertrand because he has none, Melanie because she wants to get enough to pay for the Nightly Edition in full and get it away from Bertrand's influence. Melanie's weakness comes from her short-sightedness, and she writes before she thinks, always in search for the next big story. Bertrand's is alcohol and his own greed. He wants all of New Orleans and will do anything to get it. Now, the story is separated into three parts, and I'll try and be as quick as possible. Part one is the death of a girl. It opens with Thomas Reddington's suicide, who is George Reddington's father, after finalizing details of his will and testament with his lawyer via tessellator. After death, he is arranged in his chair and a call is made. 3 days earlier, George, Jacob, Joseph, and Mickey are standing in the Café du Mans discussing how it's a bad idea that Jacob wants to marry Lizzie. That night after her shift at the Nightly Edition, Melanie stumbles on the Quarter Killer's latest victim, lending her a stay in New Orleans Police Department. Invitations are set out for the Lautrec Clockwork Crew Mardi Gras party. Melanie, free from the police department, is sent instead of Joseph. She meets a man who promises information on Bertrand. At the party, George attends a meeting in a secret smoking room, taking his father's place. He plays witness to the murder of a man in a cage. After a near drowning of Lizzie and a rescue by Mickey, a telephone call confirms that Thomas Reddington is dead. The same night, a marriage deal is struck between George and Jacob for Lizzie's hand. Melanie's informant leads her to the docks and a shifter fight for which Jacob and Mickey take part. Introduction to the Steamworks, Underground, and Boiler Number 13 is in this chapter as well. Thomas Reddington's funeral happens where Bertrand presents George with airship tickets abroad, as long as he promises to come back in time for his sister's wedding and stay back. A package is delivered to Melanie. 6 months later, Lizzie winds up dead on the French Quarter. Part two is The Truth Hurts. Frantic attempts are made to contact George, who lands in the St. Louis Cathedral Air Station and sees the headline across the Times-Picayune. Confrontation between him, Bertrand, and Jacob, which Melanie ends up staying away from the funeral. Jacob and Mickey part ways as fighters. Mickey takes to fighting on his own. Jacob takes up his father's cause against Storyville. Bandage Fighter enters the shifter ring later on in this chapter. George takes to drinking. Quarter Killer attacks get worse. New Orleans initiates a quarantine, tries to raid shifter fights. Melanie's article about the shifter fights make things even worse for both sides. She receives a phone call urging her to come to Chicago. Making the trip, she nearly dies because of a little red book, Thomas has willed her. Introduction to Mr. Dennis Strapping and his fear of number boiler 13. Bertrand takes to blaming George for the killings around New Orleans, convincing him that he's actually to blame. Melanie's informant winds up dead. Frank and Claire are at a dead end with their case into the Quarter Killer, under considerable pressure to arrest someone. We learn more about the Steamworks and Bertrand's presence in it. The shifter fights continue with Mickey losing his top spot to a bandage fighter, winding up in the hospital because of it. The next fight will be his last. George succumbs to Bertrand's guilt, convinced he is the killer, and turns himself into Claire and Frank. Bertrand behind him with an explanation and a lawyer. Melanie returns with the truth, according to Thomas Reddington. And my final part, part three, the typewriter is mightier than the automated sword. Crime scenes aren't adding up for Claire. Each time the Quarter Killer stops killing and starts again, there are differences. Lizzie's death is the strangest of all. Attributed to the killer, she was wet when she was found. Melanie returns to a nightmare. Battle lines are drowned in the sand. Mardi Gras is on the brink of cancellation. George is in jail. Jacob is absolutely useless. Storyville is in tumult with the American Social Hygienics Association closing in. Boiler number 13 has been acting strangely, not responding to repairs. Bertrand has the mayorship in hand. He can taste it. He is rich again and has the city behind him in exterminating the shifters and Storyville. Drilling will begin soon. Frank and Claire revisit the crime scene and then the Lautrec house. Melanie takes pen to paper and refutes her earlier article, hoping to change public opinion. Mr. Strapping fear grows as he's assigned to Boiler 13. Evidence is shared with Claire and Frank about Bertrand, a murder identical to Lizzie's some year before, attributed to another serial killer. A sting operation is set up at the Nightly Edition, where Bertrand is prompted to go for his victory celebration. A confession is won, and in the Steamworks, Mr. Saturday is a man that things happen to. Covering another worker's shift, he passes by Boiler 13 as it explodes with poor Mr. Strapping still working on it. And my epilogue, Bertrand makes it to Chicago on the run. Men are waiting for him, men who don't like their shipments of good liquor to be interrupted.
Whoa.
And that is Blood on the Quarter.
Wow. Okay.
That is a lot.
That is a lot.
Yes.
There's a lot, and that's very fast.
Sorry.
No. I think we can expect the first few minutes of this discussion to be questions of clarification.
Right. Yes. Which I'm happy to do. Honestly, I am. I know it's a lot. I really do.
Okay. All right. No, it's cool. The points that jumped and teased, I think, will give us threads that we can pursue to unravel the delight that you have laid out here. But let me ask right up front, Riley, what are you hoping to get out of this conversation?
Well, for me, because it is a lot, and I know it is, and I knew it was when I started writing this book. I'm hoping to kind of shave off the edges. What works, what doesn't work, and really what I need to work on. And my biggest question, honestly, is does it work? You know, am I pulling on straws here, or do I have something that can actually work? And then, does it make sense, really? And I know there are clarification questions, obviously, because it was a lot to take in, but really, that's the biggest thing. I'm hoping to kind of shave this monstrosity that I have on the table right now down to something more workable, something more in your face. Here it is. It's not as complicated as it seems. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. I think
okay.
we can
You're
help.
You're trying to find its center.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're kind of trying to figure out what your main columns are of what's holding this up. No, I understand.
Yep.
Yes, ma'am.
We can work with that. Before we dive in, Brian, would you be so kind as to cover our ass and give the ubiquitous disclaimer of the round table?
I would be thrilled. So I will.
Yes, please.
Yes. okay, so in the course of this workshopping, you will be hearing a whole lot of things from Dave and myself and from Sherry, and you are more than welcome to completely and totally disregard anything that we have to say as complete and total bullshit. More than likely, a lot of it will be. And we treat every writer that comes on as this, you are the writer, this is your story, anything that we do to it, you are under absolutely no obligation to use.
Absolutely. Very good. All right, so we will lead off the opening comments and salvos of questions for clarification to our guest host, Sherry Priest. What's your first impression of Riley's story idea? What kind of questions do we need to ask to tease out those center columns and generally just lead us into this thing?
Oh, good Lord, no pressure.
No pressure.
I really wish I had what you just read sitting in front of me kind of for reference. It's a little hard when I don't have the visual cues. I think, first of all, you had a handful of phrases that just really leaped out at me that I wanted to stop you. Like, oh, wait, tell me about that for a second. Not least of all, a life being saved under one condition and the idea of a man being murdered in a cage. Those are the two that, even though I didn't really have time to take notes, it really sprung to mind. And I think it sounded like, and I really like the idea, let me be clear, of I like to start things with money. You know, follow the money, see where the money comes from, where it's going, and then you can see who's going to be a part of the story. And when you divide it up into the different energy companies, that's really interesting. So what was it, steam and oil and electricity?
Well, it's actually the Cato Pine Line, which runs actually through Louisiana. They're the main oil suppliers in Louisiana. And then the Standard Oil and Company.
Okay, so there are two oil companies, yes?
Yeah.
Okay, but correct me if I'm wrong, because like I said, that was fast. But you're basically talking about, I thought it was electricity and oil and steam. Was I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely correct. Louisiana is actually in the flux between steam, oil, and electricity right now. All three of them are really interesting,
especially because, I mean, because that's so much money in that. There's so much at stake in that, and that's a really great, it's a really great place to put a lot of things that could go, a story wherein many, many things can go many different directions. So I think that's great. The one thing that threw me, though, toward the end when you brought the alcohol back into it, because alcohol is another vastly, it almost could be another pillar of this, or maybe it's one pillar too many. it was hard for me to tell from that. But when you have, you know, these major trades going on, these major enterprises with all of this weight behind them, that might be one too many, or I don't know, it sounded like maybe that was sort of tacked on, but I couldn't tell.
Well, right now I have it. The alcohol comes in because it's set in the Prohibition era.
Oh yeah, so maybe it should be more prominent.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sorry. My cat is crying to be let in. She's fussing at me. You're not allowed to shut doors in this house. I hope you can't hear her. Yeah, like I said, I really wish I had this on paper in front of me because that's another just majorly charged. A venue through which many powerful people have lots of money and lots to protect.
Right.
So that could be really, and I love New Orleans anyway. I grew up on the Gulf Coast, so it delights me that you're setting something there.
Excellent. Cool. Brian, first thoughts?
Yeah, mine are mostly questions. I'm going to throw just a few questions at you because they're things that I think will help clarify.
Go
just
for it.
In general.
Go for
one
it.
Is what is it ultimately that Melanie needs to accomplish within the story, and what are the two or three main obstacles that stand in her way? If you had to delineate it down to this is what she needs to accomplish by the end, and these are the two or three main things that stand in her way, what would those be? And then the same question for Bertrand. And I think that will give us a really good sense of, you know, with it's so complicated and there's so many other things that are going on that I think probably need to be there. But I just need a really good sense of those specific things.
Right. Okay. What stands in Melanie's way, let's go with Melanie. Money, obviously. She ultimately wants the Nightly Edition to be her own. She wants her own printing press. Well, money.
Is it not now?
It's actually owned by Bertrand Lautrec.
Okay, got it.
He controls the content, and Melanie is a big believer in freedom of speech. I'm going to print whatever I damn well please. Thank you very much.
Gotcha.
And so that is her ultimate goal, and Bertrand stands in her way because he has such an iron fist, and money is also a big deal for her. She can't make enough, even though she was a burlesque dancer. There's just no way for her to make enough. She has rent to pay. She's got food to buy, and Bertrand keeps hiking up the rent to keep them down. And then the third thing that really stands in her way is the quarter killer, because if she could just crack who this guy is, she would be able to make everything else happen for her. It's that one article that she needs to propel her into being a superstar. Right. Now, Bertrand, his ultimate goal is all of New Orleans. He wants the city for himself.
Let me just stop you for one second, because when you say that he wants New Orleans for himself, are you talking like he wants to own it, he wants it as a mob boss, he wants it politically? What is he looking for with it?
Politically, he wants to control it. So ultimately, he wants New Orleans politically. He wants to control the city. He has these grandiose ideas. Standing in his way is Storyville, because that leads down into the steamworks, which have been there since the Spanish occupied New Orleans. It was their gift when they left and gave it back. Who in turn gave it back to the United States. Well, he believes down there's oil, and everybody knows that oil is black gold. Well, once he gets that money, he can buy off everybody in the city, everybody that needs buying off. So really the city stands in his way, and then the Reddington family stands in his way because he has secrets of his own. So he needs to get rid of them, then he needs to get the oil, which in turn will allow him to buy out the city.
Okay.
What is it that the Reddingtons have that is standing in Bertrand's way?
May or may not be his children.
Expand.
Okay.
Briefly. Actually,
no, it's fine. Thomas and Bertrand, they met in World War I. They were comrades, and they looked so much alike that they decided to switch lives. Thomas was more interested in his medical profession than anything else, and Bertrand lives vicariously through whomever he happens to befriend, and using them up for everything that they have and then just taking them away. Well, Bertrand got himself into trouble, and he may or may not have fathered George and Lizzie without Thomas's knowledge.
Okay. And that's a problem. Why?
Because later on, in as their friendship soured and as these two men started understanding more and as Thomas got more into the eugenics movement, Thomas began to realize that Bertrand was taking him for everything that he had, and he was using his medical experiments and all of his medical knowledge to warp and twist his own and start selling off these formula that he was creating to various people to get more money, because his motivation in life is to get money. He's a narcissist like that. His only living is money. He wants it. He needs it. He has to have it. And so he was starting to sell off these formula. Well, things were starting to happen around Thomas that weren't supposed to happen. For instance, his wife all of a sudden went missing, and she came up in the Thames when they started dredging the Thames in 1901. And Thomas knew nothing about it. So now Thomas is going back, and he's starting to look really closely into Bertrand, and Bertrand knows this, and so he has to get rid of the Reddington family, or at least keep them in the dark long enough that he can make it go away, make the past go away.
I'm gonna suggest you have wrought a dense web work of correlation and interdependency and fear and
I've started taking notes. Yeah. I went and got a notebook to try to work it out.
I am going to suggest, and I don't know if we can do this, but I'm gonna suggest that we step up maybe like 5,000 feet. And look at the broad storylines, because as intriguing as this is, and I want eugenics. Ooh, eugenics, really?
Right.
I'm thinking that with the time that we have, that if we can focus in on key players and key story arcs, that we might actually be able to tease out some gold for you, Riley. Does that make sense?
That's great. Okay. Honestly,
one question I have. Tell me about shifters.
The shifters are the eugenics movement. They were used in World War I as fighters against the Germans, who had these mechanized weapons. Well, they were used as fighters in special ops. They could go in and come out and no one would be the wiser. Well, the eugenics movement made that possible. It's a step up to where, and I hate to bring this up, but it's the truth, to what the Nazis had. They were using animals to blend with people. And to make this happen. So you have, think of it like a wolfman. You have this wolfman that you have created, and you can do whatever you want with him.
Okay. Okay. So shifters are, I'm not going to say werewolves, but they're basically a hybrid between human and animal.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Awesome. Very cool. Okay. Sherry?
Has the program involving the shifters, has that been abandoned? And so now they're kind of roaming around and doing these fights to make their livelihood, or
they work on the docks or they work in the steamworks, and they just do the fights to make some extra cash.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Okay. So they're an underclass, basically,
ma'am.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, good Lord. See, I dragged out. I went to the other side of the house and got a notebook, and looking at this from 5,000 feet, I keep writing down as you keep hitting on these really huge topics that could be the engine of the plot engine of an entire novel. And I think it's so crowded with big ideas. I mean, that's how it feels to me. Like, I've written down, okay, well, what seemed to be, at 10,000 feet, what looks like the big themes, the big engines of moving of a story here. And I have media, with a newspaper, energy, and alcohol, since that's what kind of it sounded like at first, these three things. But then under energy, I have a subset, oil, steam, and electricity, which are all apparently also very important. But then we get down to serial murder, which isn't related to money at all, and I kind of don't know what to do with that. And then an identity swap and eugenics and shifters, and I'm going, wait, any one of these things could be an entire franchise.
Absolutely.
And it kind of feels like maybe this needs to be teased out into several stories or several books. But then again, I mean, that's obviously my opinion, and take it or leave it as you will. But at 5,000 feet, it looks to me like there are many very large ideas that are kind of colliding, mm-hmm. and maybe fighting for attention within the story. And they're all so big that they're a little hard to keep track of. Like, I completely forgot about the alcohol angle until you brought it up at the end of what you were saying. And you're right, it's prohibition in New Orleans. That should be huge. Right. Actually, a book about Prohibition in New Orleans that's steampunk would be totally rad. But it's like, oh, no, that sounds really cool. But I just did a New Orleans steampunk book, so I'm going to leave that alone. I just had that. Mine was set 40 years earlier anyway. There are millions and millions of steampunk New Orleans stories that can be done, and done beautifully, I certainly think and hope. And this sounds great. It really, really does. I just, like, the more I hear it, like, the more you tell us about it, every time we digress on some new subject, there's some huge new thing.
Yeah.
But I go, oh, well, that would make a really interesting setting for a book, or that would be a really interesting kind of axis, plot axis for a really big story. But I feel like there are a lot of really big ones, and they're all kind of colliding, and maybe there's not enough room for all of this stuff to be in one story.
Yeah.
But that is from having listened to an 8-minute thing that I really wish I had the paperwork in front of me, because it sounds really cool.
Well,
but
Riley,
I'm having a hard time kind of teasing it out.
Riley, let me ask you this. What is this story about? Give us a thematic perspective. Is this a story of redemption? Is this a story of one woman standing against big civilization engines to seize her glory? Is this a story about corruption? I mean, can you distill it down to what is this story about?
And originally, you're right, Sherry, there's a lot of big ideas because I have them, and it's like, oh, that would be so cool.
They're great ideas.
They are.
I don't mean to imply that they're not. They're fantastic. Go ahead.
And for me, it's like, and then I think that's why I'm having so much trouble, because I'm trying to put them all in my head, and it's just not working, and I'm like, ah! But it's a story of secrets, lies, and their consequences of murder, manipulation, and science with a chance at redemption. And really, it's not so much a story of Melanie as she propels the story, as she's going on, you know, this quest to figure out what's going on. Everything else kind of happens.
She's a vehicle character.
Right. Everything else happens around her. The Reddington's secret comes out. Bertrand's secret comes out. And, you know, and now it's an oh shit factor. Now we have to play the cover up. Now what are we going to do? You know, who's going to come out the winner?
But if she's not the person who's actually driving any of the action, maybe she shouldn't be the person who's the center of the story. I mean, maybe
right.
It should be one of Bertrand's people or one of the other guy's people. If she is just a vehicle character, if she hasn't done anything to make any of this happen, and it's kind of happening around her, the example kind of springs to mind, and it may be a little controversial because obviously all art is subjective. The movie From Hell, mm-hmm. I thought was really great, except for the fact that the detective may as well have just not showed up that day.
Oh, no.
Right.
Like, nothing
right.
would have been different if he had just not been there, and because he was really just a vehicle character. But I thought it would have been a much more interesting story told from the point of view of, you know, one of the prostitutes or maybe somebody in the royal family, because these were the people who were actually pushing the buttons. They were the ones actually pulling the levers. And at 5,000 feet, because you seem to be withdrawing in your conversation from her, you're starting to distance yourself from her because now we're starting to look at all the other things going on in here. If she's just kind of along for the ride, if it's kind of on a rail, I don't know. Maybe she's not the right protagonist for the story.
The way I have it now, and you're right, and I agree. The way I have it is, it's told from different perspectives. I have it from George's. I have it from Mickey's,
okay.
And then I have it from Melanie's. Because she is as much as she is a vehicle right now. She is integral to the story. I can't completely remove her without removing a lot of story that happens, unless I can figure out a way to rewrite it. I guess.
You don't have to remove her, but maybe she doesn't need to be one of the focal protagonists is all.
Right. And that's actually a good idea.
Yeah.
If you could limit it down to three POVs, could you tell this story with three POVs? And if so, which three?
Oh, yeah. No, totally. I could. I could tell it from George's. I could tell it from Lizzie's, as short as her POV is. I could tell it from George's, Lizzie's, and then I would have to tell it from Melanie's, because as... what happens in Chicago is equally as important as what happens in New Orleans when she goes up to Thomas's lawyer to receive everything. It's a little red book that makes all the difference for her.
Well, and that was something that the trip to Chicago mm-hmm. almost seems extraneous.
Mm-hmm. You think?
I mean, granted, the events that occur in Chicago, very important. Absolutely. That red book that reveals the secrets, and it's what everybody's fighting for, and yada, yada. It's essential to the big reveal at the end. But in the context of the story, I mean, it sounds, with all the stuff you're pulling in, all the characters, all the events that are going on, Sherry did a, thank you for that lovely pillar post of media, energy, alcohol, eugenics, those various key elements, the shifters. This is a story about New Orleans, it seems like, not necessarily about, and maybe it's influence in the outside world, but definitely told from inside the city. And to have the right. characters leave that city almost feels like, unnecessary.
A cop-out almost?
Now you're, well, no, it's like now not only, well, we have media and different kinds of, and energy, but different kinds of energy, and this, and this, and this, oh, and also another city.
Right. Okay, I see.
I thought it was about this city, you know?
Right. No, I can see that. Yeah, and I'd actually been feeling like that for a little while. Like, do I really need this? Or can she just get the package and forget about it for a little while all of this?
Yeah, have someone mail it to her. Shoot.
Absolutely.
Maybe she doesn't open it right away or, you know.
Yeah.
Somebody
yeah.
forgets to give it to her. It can be a little side, some minor thing. Oh, somebody accidentally doesn't give it to her. It gets delivered to the house next door. I mean, there are any number of ways you could just kind of have her not receive it, but not necessarily realize what it is right away.
Sure. You could even set it up that like a lot of people know that it's on the way. As soon as Reddington dies, everybody knows that the red book is on its way to New Orleans. And, you know, there could be a whole side story about, you know, intercepting the red book and claiming, getting the red book and bada bada. You know, there's all sorts of, you don't need to leave New Orleans, I don't think. And I think if you do, that you'd be, as Sherry said, adding another city to what is already a very, very rich and dense environment.
Yeah, okay. I agree.
I really agree with that. And like I said, I've been feeling like that for a while. You know, does she need to leave, or do I have enough in New Orleans to keep her there?
You've got enough.
Go with your gut. Go with your gut. You have plenty. Go and follow those instincts.
Absolutely. Yeah,
they're good instincts.
Brian, what else you got, bud?
You know, I'm looking at this whole thing, and I'm really thinking, I'm digging the idea of it being almost serialized, you know, like, because there's so many different things that you're dealing with that I don't think that Bertrand needs to lose at the end of this. I think that it's a continuation, and that if he's that kind of smarmy, that it's not, I'm going for everything all at once. It's, I'm going for this one thing, and then when I don't get it and I get foiled, I'm going to turn my mind to oil, and then I'm going to turn my mind to this other thing. But one thing that I really keep coming back to over and over is I love Storyville, and I want a lot of things to take place in Storyville. And I had written down before you even answered this, because when I was asking you the questions about what does Bertrand need and what does Melanie need, I wrote down, why does Bertrand want to get rid of Storyville? And then I put, why really? And, you know, if the only reason that he wants to get rid of it is to get down below it and get into the oil, that's fine. But I kind of feel like Storyville is one of those places that a lot of people have a lot of shit on a lot of people. You know what I mean? Because there's prostitution, and there's all kinds of different things that are going on down there. Yeah, and so you can't go into Storyville and get anything that you want, even if it's a pack of gum, without somebody then getting something on you. And so it's a place of secrets, and it's a place of sort of that bartered trust. And there are so many things to be learned. Yeah. In that area, I just I'm really intrigued by that concept.
Nobody comes out of Storyville clean.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a place of power. The low places, and I'm using finger quotes, those are places of power. You can't just scrape them off the map. Those people know way too much of your dirty laundry. But you're right. That's fascinating. The idea of I played with for a while in one of my other books, Barataria Bay. You know, the old pirate enclave out there, for kind of the same reason. The low places, there's power there. And, I love that idea. Because otherwise it kind of sounds a little bit like the Muppet movie, you know, where the guy's just going to destroy Muppet Land or the studio because he wants to drill for oil or whatever.
Or Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yeah. Right. Like, no, come on. There's this is way too interesting for somebody to just kind of idly decide to destroy out of hand for some minor reason. Because that's a really awesome thing you've set up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah. The vibe I was getting, Riley, was, and this is going to be really weird and people might not know it, but the Dukes of Hazzard, Bertrand kind of is coming off like Boss Hogg.
Boss Hogg.
Really? Yeah. Well, I'm looking at.
I can kind of see that.
Well, yeah. I'm looking, Riley, at your description. He wants money. He wants money, and money is a symptom. Money isn't necessarily an end. It's not the real objective. So, you know,
if he got it, he wouldn't be happy with it. He'd want something else. What's the something else?
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And if he does own New Orleans isn't going to be enough. There's going to have to be more. So what is it really that Bertrand is reaching for so desperately?
And that is a really good question.
Awesome. We put it out to the table. Sherry, what do you think Bertrand could really be going for?
Oh, well, people who are that greedy, as often as not, it's security. It's power because they feel insecure. They want to feel like they're on top because they feel weak and powerless, and so they define themselves by the acclamation of power. Maybe something bad happened to him. Maybe his mother died, there are a zillion and one things that could turn him into somebody who just can't have enough because there's never enough. You know, it turns into that bottomless hole of what you're talking about doing is taking a 2D character and turning it into a 3D character. Yes. You talk about a stereotype like, oh, well the bitchy old mother-in-law, that's a 2D character. It becomes a 3D character when you understand that this woman lost her husband, and this daughter is all she has left, and so she's very protective of her, and she's not sure that she married the right man. And like, these are the things that make those characters real people instead of cardboard cutouts. You need to know what it is he really wants. But, I mean, sometimes there are people with very big egos, and that's fine. They're out there. But there is usually something behind it, you know. Maybe he was poor, you know. Maybe he started out under bad circumstances, and now he's got a lot to prove. Sure. Just having a lot to prove with a certain kind of personality type, with a certain kind of ego. I think at some point or another, most of us know have met one of those people at some point.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, just off the top of my head, that's the first thing that springs to mind. It's somebody who's in search of security, who's never going to find enough.
Yeah.
And money represents security or success or stability or something that he lost or lacked at some point.
Yeah. Brian, anything to add to that?
I would throw in the concept of avoidance of ruin, that he's somebody already of stature and that he's been involved in certain dealings that if it got out, then he's done, he's toast. And the fact that he owns the press or that particular press, he's able to keep certain stories from getting out. But if he can control all of New Orleans, then he's in a position where it doesn't matter if it gets out at that point because he's already got, you know, he's on the top. And so I think that avoidance of ruin drives people to do some really crazy shit, and you know, and then that could tie into Storyville too. Maybe there's something in Storyville that you know, he can say, let's get rid of it so we can get the oil and you know, that'll make me powerful and whatever, and I'll have money and I can take over New Orleans. But if there's something else that's underlying it that he has done that it can't get out, that he has a connection to it, or he's ruined and loses everything, he's going to fight like hell to get up on top to a point where he can just step on people that can say bad things about him. You know,
and secrets. I mean, clearly, you know, if Riley, you can go through and figure out some of the really nasty things that not only that he's done, but some of the things that he knows. I mean, maybe he knows something that doesn't even come out in this story, that scares the hell out of him. And being a controlling, manipulative bastard, his natural instinct to defend against this thing that scares him so much is to get control. And maybe he's not, you know, trying to secure New Orleans for his own aggrandizement and security, but as a preparation or a stronghold against something dark that scares even him.
Right. I just had the coolest idea.
Yeah, go.
Put his secrets in the red book, and you've set yourself a time limit. He has to achieve X amount of power before the contents of the red book become public, and he knows the red book is coming.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you've jacked up his motivation. Now you've given him you've got a ticking time bomb now. If something that is in the Red Book can possibly destroy him, and he knows the Red Book is coming, he has to achieve enough. He may not know it's coming right this moment, but he knows it's there. And then when it turns out that it's on its way, he has to make his move. Like, now it's not just this is a man who likes to acquire power. Now this is somebody who really has to take action because there's something concrete coming to destroy him.
Right.
I like
that. And if you jump away from him for a second to Melanie, now she has... not necessarily, I don't know about more motivation, but she definitely
agency.
Is.
She has agency if she has the book.
Right. And the fact that she's looking into things that he's thwarting, that she's like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? This is, you know, I have credible evidence for this. And she becomes such a risk to him that she is in danger, and that's going to propel her even more to try to find what the truth is, and now she has a little bit more, more you know, chutzpah to her.
Yeah.
That makes her more of that central protagonist. Yeah,
of a vehicle character and somebody who's actually participating in the events rather than just kind of following them around.
Right. Riley, I wanted to ask, who is the serial killer?
You never said.
You know, I got to keep some things to myself, right?
No, you don't.
The workshop.
Don't let him bully you.
If you don't want to, I mean, don't. It's cool. Just as long as you know who it is, and in the end, when you do reveal who it is, it makes sense. It should be surprising, but it should make sense.
Right.
Actually, right now, I'm actually playing with that idea right now. I have it between Bertrand actually being the serial killer, being the guy who's trying to murder all of these people around New Orleans and make it look like these shifters who everybody knows live in Storyville are doing it so he can get Storyville gone off the map and wiped out, or having him pay somebody to do all of these things for him so he's not touchable. I didn't do it. I'm not here. I don't know what you're talking about.
Could be the secret in the red book, you know? Yeah. The fact that there's some tie of money between him and whoever it is he's hiring to do this. And that way it's not random serial killing. There's something that links them all together, and that's something else Melanie can stumble upon or chase.
Yes. Right. And
I want to see her chasing things and not following things, you know?
Yeah. True. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. So I think it would also help if the serial killer, if he does hire this guy or whatever, if it gets a little out of control and the guy starts doing some side jobs of his own.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that Bertrand never intended. Maybe he has to do something about him.
Well,
Right.
Yes, that's awesome.
Actually, the informant that Melanie has, he's the guy doing the jobs for Bertrand. He's actually trying to lead her, say, hey, look, this is what's going on. You need to be watching these things because I can't tell you, otherwise Bertrand's going to kill me. Never mind that he ends up dead anyway. And that's why I have Bertrand actually going to George, because if he can mess with George's head, then he can kill two birds with one stone. You see what I'm saying? His secret stays buried with George, who ends up getting locked up. And then he can focus on getting rid of Melanie because, you know, all of a sudden she's knowing things she's not supposed to know by way of this other guy who was never supposed to do these things because Bertrand's paying him good money to not do these things.
Mm-hmm. Who's the informant?
I actually haven't even given him a name yet.
Okay. That's an interesting character. The character who's playing the two sides, that's an interesting character.
Double agent.
Yeah.
He's from Storyville.
Yes. Yeah. They're all from Storyville.
So
I just love Storyville. Yeah.
So Lizzie is Bertrand's daughter.
She may or may not be. That's the big secret, and that's one of the secrets in the red book.
Okay. And George is George Bertrand's son.
Yes.
Okay. And the other victim of the serial killer is Tom Reddington.
No, actually, Thomas takes his own life. He's a suicide because that's the way that he can make these things happen. He starts the chain of events.
Who got killed in the cage?
That was cool.
Yeah, he actually didn't get killed. That was my informant. He didn't get killed. He was playing at getting killed so Bertrand could make a show for Storyville. Say, this is what's living in Storyville. This is what the mayor has been suppressing in Storyville. This is what you people need to know. And he's doing this in front of all of these major players in politics, in Louisiana's politics. I don't know if you guys know anything about the crew parties, but the big crew parties mm-hmm. that use Mardi Gras are the rich folks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they've been doing this for years.
Yeah, they're all the old money. Yeah, all the old Southern money.
Louisiana. That have been doing this, and Bertrand is one of them. His family is old enough that he has his own crew. So they invite all of the politicals, and they get the money, and then they do the parade, blah, and everybody loves Mardi Gras. So, mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm still losing. I'm not taking the thread of the guy in the cage. Help me out.
The guy in the cage is my informant. He's not actually dead. Bertrand shoots him with a blank. He pretends to be dead, and then that same night, he goes to Melanie and says, look, there's this murder that's happened at Bertrand's house. You need to look into it. So Melanie goes and she starts looking into this. Nothing's coming up. And one thing leads to another. The informant ends up dead, and Melanie starts figuring out that something's wrong and Bertrand is in the middle of it. But because
okay. All right. Got it. All right. What if, here we go. What if, tying into the eugenics line, what if Bertrand was one of the first test subjects for a eugenic serum.
Ooh, that's good.
And has had a deep and abiding history with the Shifters being a part of that program.
Right.
And some bizarre quirk or something about the formula or whatever, but it's turned him, and here's where my idea thread goes totally to crap, but it's something... Something bad, something that has led him to go off and kill his offspring or try to kill his offspring so that it doesn't spread.
Oh, I like that.
Interesting.
It ties it all together nicely.
Yeah.
If you can figure out what that MacGuffin is.
Yeah. See, right. There's that word MacGuffin again. Holy crap. Am I Captain MacGuffin? Is that it?
You are.
God damn it.
What I really like about that is... especially if you're playing with sort of almost class warfare in a way, and all of the Shifters are like lower than the lower class. They're just dirt. And so they have these underground fights because they have to survive and they have to make this money. And if anybody finds out that he is one or had been tested on or whatever, he loses all of his status with high society.
Right. Oh, see?
Sure. The taint of the bloodline. Uh-huh. And the inherent taint that Shifters have, because they're basically not human anymore. They're the other now. And to have Bertrand aligned with that in any way could be,
just destroys him. Yeah. And if they're all living in Storyville, then that gives him more impetus to destroy Storyville before any... anybody can do any kind of blood test to find that he's part of it.
There's going
to
be, maybe there's Shifters in there that were with Bertrand in the in the program.
Ooh, you could have like a crime lord of shift of story.
Totally.
You have a crime lord who was part of the same program, and it's like the only person who actually is living who knows, and Bertrand can't touch him because he can't get to him there in Storyville, and that's why he really wants to destroy the place.
Right.
Because that guy's holed up in there like a toad in a hole.
And
that's badass.
But what if that guy, I love that guy. What if that guy is actually helping Bertrand become the king of New Orleans? Because he's got something on Bertrand, and having the king of the Shifters have the mayor of New Orleans in his pocket.
In his pocket.
Oh, yeah.
Very nice. See, now everybody has motivations. It's like starting to thread. Like this sounds like a mechanic that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And Melanie can fit into that as see. And the other thing that I wrote down and underlined is secrets in those threads that bind everybody together. And a reporter is going to be the worst person to have. Not a reporter. An independent reporter.
Right.
A reporter who's actually
a freelancer.
Yes, exactly. Who's interested in the truth is the worst person to have in New Orleans, which makes Melanie persona non grata at every social event, every single thing. Why the hell isn't Melanie dead? That's what I want to know right now.
Yeah, well, that was another question that I had, too, was why if she works for Bertrand, and Bertrand is in control of the serial killer. Why hasn't he just killed her?
Well, because,
or had her killed?
Because Melanie is the only reporter that still stays on with the Nightly Edition. So in order to get that revenue stream with the Nightly Edition, he has to have a reporter. As much as he wants her dead, he's got to have some way to have money until he can get some of his own. That's the standpoint that I'm working on right now. Although I'm sure there's a better one that I can come up with.
Yeah.
Because
if he's that powerful, then it seems like you can put an ad in the paper and get 50 people who think they're writers to show up and work for your paper.
Sure.
Right.
And who will do what they're told.
Yeah.
Yes, and who will do what they're told. And she clearly won't. So there needs to be some good reason that he hasn't offed her yet.
Ooh,
and the threat of that can absolutely loom. It sounds interesting, you know, because like the looming peril kind of encroaching. I mean, that's great. But but you're right. I mean, I think it sounds like there needs to be some specific reason that he hasn't just gone to town on her yet.
Well, how about this? How about this? Melanie was a burlesque dancer. She's got a shady and sordid past. She's a creature of New Orleans. At the start of the book, she is totally in Bertrand's pocket. She's living high off the hog. She's taking the money. She's putting out the crap that Bertrand is shoveling her cheerfully. And then something happens.
Right.
That you know, and maybe she doesn't feel real good about that. Maybe you know, we have to give her some spark of nobility that would make her want to buck this monstrous, ancient, creaking system of codependency and payoffs and graft and corruption to suddenly become the person that she needs to be to really be worthy of her position at the Nightly Edition. I don't know what that is, but having that moment where she starts off in his pocket and decides to throw off that yoke, that seems like it's got mojo as far as story strength and conflict.
Definitely, yeah.
Uh-huh. Back
in Melanie. See, we're writing fanfic about your proposal. It's great.
Yes, exactly. Riley, is any of this, tweaking or resonating with you?
I've got like 3 note cards full up right now.
Sweet. Yeah, no,
yeah, no, you guys have given me so much to think about. This is so awesome and exactly what I need. You guys are my right now. Seriously.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm looking at the clock and I'm seeing the time start to tick down. So I wanted to take us into sort of that final closing stages where first, Riley, we start with you and ask, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you really hoped that we would?
No, you guys hit everything. Let me tell you. You guys did.
awesome. Then let's go around the table and we'll start with Sherry, and let's each of us give Riley some final thoughts, some final observations, and send her off to with pen blazing in her hand to craft an awesome story. Sherry, we'll start with you.
Thanks. No, see, I think it sounds like an amazing world, and I realize I'm a little bit biased. Like I said, I'm a Gulf Coast girl. I grew up in Southeast Texas and on the Gulf Coast of Florida, and I spent a lot of time in New Orleans, and I love it. And you have so many great ideas. I don't want to see them compete for attention, basically, I think is what I'm trying to say. I think if you can split this up into maybe several stories or several books in this world setting, kind of give each theme a little room to breathe. You know, maybe media and the eugenics is kind of the start of this one, or maybe save the prohibition issue for another story, because you've got a million and one really great characters going on here. And you're young. You're young. I can tell by your voice. You have lots of time. just sit down and type and keep telling more stories about this, because you've got a million and one of them. You don't have to put them all in one thing.
Okay.
Right.
Excellent advice. Brian, how about you, sir?
One thing that jumped out that I just wanted to say careful on is over caricaturizing. Is that a word?
Sure.
Not making an overly, okay. Anyway, you know, over caricaturizing, Bertrand as the evil newspaper guy, the evil politician, the evil oil baron, and, you know what I mean? And that's where I was kind of thinking originally that maybe some of these things that he does, it's not because that's what he really believes, but it's, well, this didn't work, let's try this, and this didn't work, and let's try this. And so he's not he's not 100% committed to every evil deed that is attributed to him in that way. I don't know if that makes any sense at all. But I think just making him real and not a caricature of any particular agenda. But I think that overall, this could definitely be parsed out into several different pieces. All of which I think have equal merit, and I think you have one hell of a world here and a hell of a story. So get to it and good luck.
Yes, definitely. And I will definitely reaffirm both of those sentiments. The world building that you've done, Riley, is rich, and I understand all too well the ooh, and this would be so cool if, and banga banga banga, and I'm so down with that. But yeah, either narrowing the vision, the scope, finding out, as we started off with, you know, what those pillars of the story are. Sherry very nicely detailed what the pillars of the town are. Find out how the pillars of your story align with those pillars of the town. And maybe they don't directly. I don't know. Considering breaking it out, making it either a trilogy, or I'm going to throw out the Dresden Files, you know, Jim Butcher's
right.
Oh, yeah.
Dresden Files is
well played.
Yeah, exactly. And there is an overarching story that continues to unfold. Laurel K. Hamilton does the same thing with her series. Mm-hmm. And you can, there's no need to spend your wad on one story when you've got so much richness in here.
Especially if you're going to pitch it at somebody. New York loves the trilogy.
They
love multi-book deals. If you can stretch this out in two or three related books, I think you'll have I don't think you'll have any trouble selling it, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's got the legs. It's got the cojones to make that happen. considering Bertrand, you know, Bertrand continues to capture, I think, all of our attentions in some way, shape, or form.
We all love a villain.
Yeah, everybody loves a villain. Having him be both S.H.I.E.L.D. and Bane of New Orleans in some way, and I know that's vague, but having him be a defender of some kind against some... You know, maybe he keeps the city working in some essential way. So taking him out is off the table. But by the same token, the way he does it is so nefarious and so wrong, morally reprehensible, whatever. You know, as Brian was saying, find those dimensions to him and let the audience in on what those are. And doing the same thing with Melanie, doing the same thing, you know, as it stands right now, it's kind of a pulpy thing. And I'm kind of in that because I'm doing a pulp fiction podcast where everybody's very much done in broad strokes and I'm this and I'm that. And maybe taking a bit of smudge eraser and making those lines a little grayer, a little darker over here, a little lighter over here, and seeing what you end up with. I don't envy you the days and nights and days and nights and days and nights ahead of you as you explore this, but by the same token, I know it's going to be a grand adventure.
Thanks very much, everybody, for taking the time and doing this with me. You guys have given me so much to work with right now. It's ridiculous.
That's awesome. Well, and thank you. Now, I will tell you, Riley, that if listen to me, when this story or stories come to life, here's the deal.
Mm.
When this thing hits ebook or Dead Tree or whatever, when that deal is signed, whatever, you come back to the round table and we will knight you. You will become a knight of the Round Table Podcast, and we will put your picture and tell your tale, singing it from the mountaintops.
Brilliant. No, honey, let me tell you, y'all are getting a damn acknowledgments page.
We'll take it.
Thanks for trusting us with it. I mean, you know, it's hard to share this stuff with people. Believe me, I know I've never played well with others when it came to this sort of thing. The fact that you're actually looking to fix it, like you want to know what you can do to make it better. I mean, that you will go far, basically.
Yes.
When people get really defensive about their material and don't want to show it to anyone or don't want to take any feedback, that's when they run into trouble. But you have so many good ideas, and just I think all you need is a little focus, and you're just pretty much going to take over the world. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
And we were there at the beginning.
That's right. We were there.
Yes, agreed. Riley, you do share that trait that all guest writers on the Roundtable Podcast share, and that is the courage and the commitment to your craft to take that risk and put it out there. And we deeply appreciate that.
Oh, I am not asking for help, let me tell you. If I need for it.
Awesome. Sherry, thank you so very much for weighing
in. Thanks
for
having me again.
Yes, exactly. There's gratitude all around for weighing in, for offering so many wonderful clarifying points and opening up new possibilities. We so very much appreciate you taking the time and helping all of us out today. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks again for having me. You guys are amazing.
Oh, see, we never get tired of hearing that. Brian, thoughts, feelings as we sit back and light a cigarette at the end of this particular episode?
Oh my Lord. No, I'm really excited about this, and I think it was a great pairing. I think Sherry brought a ton to this particular story, and you know, Riley for bringing it on. I appreciate you guys. I think it's excellent. Yep. So, you know, I think it's going to go somewhere.
Well, and I think that so much goodness in this episode, but I think a lot of us are in Riley's position as we do our world building, as we craft our characters, as we look at all the cool stuff that we can put into the story. Oh my God. And it was really helpful, to be on this side of the discussion and help find what it is to look for to help narrow that down and reinforce
Absolutely.
What's strong. Yeah. So this was awesome. And as long as we're throwing out gratitude, then we have to include you all, that all of you who hit the play button, you rock.
Yes.
Thank you for tuning in. We hope this was as awesome for you as it was for us. The best way you can show us some love for that is to spread the word. Tell your friends, write Aunt Nettie. You know she wants to know about this. She's got to know about this. And, you know, a review on iTunes is always nice. Many of you have been throwing comments on the comments section of the posts. We are grateful for that, and we try to weigh in as often as we can. An email is always nice, thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. And generally, just reach out, because we love to hear from you guys. Stay tuned. In just a few days, as awesome as all of this is, it starts all over again. Another guest host, another story put up by a courageous and creative guest writer. The process is ongoing as we continue our quest for literary gold. Until those few days pass, Brian.
Yes.
What do they need to be doing?
They need to go write.
Go write.
And that's what I need to be doing, too.
You and me both, brother.
Yes.
Friends, go out there, look for awesomeness, and you will find it. Until next time, you guys stay frosty, keep writing, find those marvelous things, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.